Welcome to Social Justice Matters, a podcast from Social Justice Ireland. My name is Colette Bennett and I'm a research and policy analyst with Social Justice Ireland. Hopefully everyone listening is feeling safe and well at the moment as we start to ease ourselves out of this lockdown. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Robert Thornton, Senior Research and Policy Officer with the Vincentian Partnership for Social Justice. Robert, you're very welcome and thank you so much for doing this with us.
Well, certainly, thank you for having me on.
So the Vincentian Partnership for Social Justice, it was established in 1995 to work on social and economic change and to tackle poverty and social exclusion. Can you tell me a little bit more about your work?
Yes, so there's two main aspects of the partnership's work. They started primarily for the focus on voter education and active citizenship programs. That's working with various groups to encourage and see the importance of voting and participating in the political process and the value in that. And in the course of that work, that led them to do more work with households in sort of very severe poverty and income inadequacy, which over time then led to starting to do budget standards research, which evolved now to what we call the minimum essential standard of living work, which entails working with groups of people to establish what's needed for a socially acceptable minimum standard of living. What do people need to live with dignity? What's the minimum required to take part in day-to-day life? And we use a methodology called consensual budget standards, which involves convening groups of members of the public in what are called deliberative focus groups to discuss all the items that are required and ultimately come up with a comprehensive basket of all the goods and services that people need for their day-to-day life to live at this socially acceptable minimum level, a standard that we say nobody should be expected to live below, a standard that enables a life with dignity. And this, as I said, this kind of evolved from working with groups to see the importance of voting to ultimately then now this approach that we take while the voting work also continues. And so this work, it has been going on since the early 2000s, and in its current form, using the current methodology, the first study was published in 2006, and we've been developing it since then. And it's part of a internationally recognized approach. It's used in the UK, France, Portugal, the same method that we use. It's used in Japan and Singapore and Thailand and South Africa. Australia have a similar but slightly different method. And then other European countries are also using it's all part of broadly what's called a reference budget research. It's a slightly different approach of where focus groups and experts take where they come in the process, but ultimately it's the goal is to establish this budget and an actual cost of what's needed for this acceptable minimum standard of living.
It's an acceptable minimum standard, and it really is a minimum standard. This isn't a luxurious lifestyle. It's kind of a subsistence or just above subsistence level, isn't that right?
Yeah, so I mean, it's meant to be about more than survival. So in that sense, it's an attempt to put into practice and establish a real and tangible benchmark of all of these kind of notions and concepts that underpin when we talk about poverty and so on. So when we talk about the official definitions of poverty and social inclusion, it's about being able to participate in day-to-day life and the norms of normal social life. And then there's like the UN human right to an adequate standard of living, or the European pillar of social rights as a commitment to an adequate income to enable a life with dignity. So there's all of these notional things, but then how do we put those into practice? And so this research seems like a good approach to say, if we sit down with groups of members of the public for different types of households and have a very focused discussion with a group about what is needed, and they kind of go through all the items, all the food that's needed week to week, clothes that are needed, household goods, things for social inclusion, things for education, transport, and so on. So there's a very comprehensive list, and it's not just one group then that establishes that list. So the first group that you'd meet with, they'll come up with a kind of a basket of, then a subsequent group will review that, and then a subsequent group will review that again. And so through this iterative process, consensus is built on what's required. And that gives us then this list of over 2,000 goods and services for any type, particular type of household, which is then priced, and every item has a lifespan. And from that, then you can work out what the average weekly cost is over, for the average for over a year, over multiple years. So it, and like we say, it ranges from everything from the fruit and vegetables you have every week, right through to the pieces of furniture in the house. So, you know, some things are being bought every week, some things are being bought once every 10 years, but all of those costs are factored in to give us a final price effectively. And that's examined each year and updated each year to reflect changes in costs.
When you say, when you talk about the focus groups, how were the focus groups selected?
So that's evolved a little bit over time, but the goal is that they are representative groups of a particular type of household. So they're not just people in poverty, they're not just people on low incomes. It's a mixed, socially, economically mixed background. So, but the groups represent the type of household in question. So if it's two-parent household with children, younger children, then it would be people, adults of that type. If it's a single working age adult, then the focus group is composed of those. If it's older people who are retired and depend on the pension, the groups are comprised of those types. And similarly, urban and rural. So we'd have urban and rural groups for each type of household. And so in the end, then we have established budgets for about 90% of households in Ireland for urban and rural. So we have single adults and couples which are working age without children, two-parent and one-parent households with 1 to 4 children. And we would identify different costs for children at 4 different age groups, and then older people, single, living alone, and couples.
And you've also produced, and I remember back in the day being one of the testers for it, the calculator for different types of households. Mm. And that's a really excellent resource. And it's I suppose the MESL, the minimum essential standard of living, that budgeting exercise. I know it gets referenced quite a lot. It gets referenced quite a lot, kind of on a very broad spectrum. Everyone from kind of NGOs to debt advisors to insolvency practitioners to the insolvency service itself. Yes. I know it's the basis for the RLE, so the reasonable living expenses within the insolvency service. They took a slightly different approach though, didn't they? They kind of took your work but kind of modified it a little bit in terms of what was acceptable in and out.
Yes, yeah. So that was back in 2013. The Insolvency Service for Ireland was set up, and they had to establish what they referred to as reasonable living expenses to determine what people would be allowed to keep to live on before having to service their debts. In effect, and so they based these reasonable living expenses on our work. So it's a complicated process. They reviewed our baskets. Fortunately, we just finished a fairly comprehensive review of what was in the MESL baskets at the time. So they were able to review those. With some political consultation, there was some, restrictions from the legislation establishing it. And then they wanted it to be, I suppose, as straightforward as possible for those using it. So while we have, we differentiate between urban and rural households in ours, they decided they didn't want to be in a position of sort of saying this rural household has slightly different reasonable living expense allowance than an equivalent urban household. And so instead they distinguish on the basis of whether a household needs a car or not, and then there's an allowance made for having a car. And to be fair, that is the primary difference in the way, but there are other subtle differences in the minimum needs for urban and rural households in our budgets. The primary difference is around the car costs. They took out certain things that the focus groups had felt were important, that people had agreed and have continued to agree as the research has gone on since then, are important as part of the minimum. So things like being able to have a short holiday in Ireland, that's not included in the reasonable living expenses. A provision for having a basic health insurance package is part of the minimum standard, but not included in the reasonable living expenses. And a few other minor those first two weren't minor adjustments, and a few other minor adjustments then made as well. To establish those, they also they have adults and parents and children. They don't differentiate between older and working age adults. They're just adults just in general. But it, having said all that, you know, it has provided a basis for these reasonable living expenses. They've been accepted. They've been stood up to, you know, scrutiny and challenge in courts and by banks and debtors and so on. So in that regard, it has meant that they are based on some sort of evidence and research, and not just an arbitrary proportion of average earnings or poverty line or something, some other sort of approach that might have been taken.
And I mean, to be fair, you know, while they did kind of discount some of the things that you would have in the meso, they also have that element of special circumstances. So, you know, you can include back in for a car, you can include in terms of childcare costs, and then there is that special circumstances piece where if one needs medical equipment or medical insurance and has kind of a documented need for it, that can be included as well. So, you know, I feel like I should be fair to the insolvency service to kind of say that they kind of allow for that as well. You know, it's really interesting that research that started with yourselves out of a completely different purpose, as you say, you know, through the kind of voter participation piece, is used now in terms of, you know, banking and lending, and, you know, and it does form part of lending decisions in terms of how the RLEs are used as well. So it's that the reach that you've been able to have has been incredible from that perspective.
Yeah.
And just again, then moving on from I suppose the MESL, it also forms the basis of the calculation of the living wage. And your organisation, the same as our own, is part of the Living Wage Technical Group. Now, I know this year's release has been postponed until September, but even based on last year's calculation, the living wage was €12.30 per hour compared to the new national minimum wage that was introduced this year of €10.10 per hour. Why do you think there's such a disparity in that?
Yeah, I suppose ultimately the living wage is an attempt to say what's a wage that's actually based on evidence, based on cost of living, based on enabling some sort of standard. The minimum wage is the product of sort of various negotiations between different points of view, political considerations, various arguments around different economic considerations, which one may or may not agree with. And so in that sense, again, I suppose it is like with the RLEs, it is a question of something that's evidence-based and based on an actual tangible standard versus something that's a kind of a negotiated proportion of something else to try and estimate what some people might agree is or is not an acceptable standard. This is what is interesting, since we started the living wage back in 2014, and the disparity between the living wage rate then of $11.45 an hour and the minimum wage of $8.65 was a lot larger than the gap now. And obviously now the living wage has gone up year on year from the $11.45 originally to $12.30 an hour, as you said. But the big factor, as we've seen the rate increase each year, the big factor behind that has been housing costs and rents. Because in the living wage, we base our housing costs on a slightly below average rent for the single adult across the country. And that has gone up every year, as won't be a surprise for anyone to hear. And so what we see now is that the ratio, as I said, is 12-13 an hour. But what was really interesting is that if housing costs had moved in line with just living costs generally, then the living wage rate wouldn't have gone up. It would actually have gone down, and it would be 10.50 an hour now, which is much closer to our minimum wage of 10.10. So really we can see the impact of ongoing spiraling rental costs on that. And you know, and really what's very telling then as well is that in our production of the living wage each year and our kind of press releases and the discussion on the media that we get in each July when we normally produce the new rate, what's come back from the employer side now more and more is they've also recognized this housing issue is that's behind it. And their kind of point, their contention generally isn't that the living wage itself is a bad idea. It's that what's driving it is housing, and it's not their job to address housing costs. It's, you know, it's government and society in a broader terms. And so, you know, how now we're both kind of, I wouldn't say we're singing off the same hymn sheet, but, you know, we're both two different sides are kind of identifying this very same issue as driving this thing. Now, their concern, obviously, is they as employers don't want to have to pay such a rate. Our concern is we want people to be able to afford to live at some sort of acceptable standard of living. But ultimately, housing is the big issue. How we solve that is obviously a very different question. And
a different podcast.
Thanks.
but it's certainly kind of worth highlighting that fact that, you know, because there is that discussion when we talk about the living wage, and you know, historically there had always been that kind of push from employers to say, you know, it's just not affordable when you think of the in the context of the SME sector and the proportion of employment, that it just isn't sustainable for small businesses to keep increasing, to keep pace with that. But that recognition that actually, you know, if housing costs had increased at a normal rate rather than the spiral that we've seen, that actually we'd be a lot more aligned, really. That it's a matter of sense. In terms of the difference between the minimum wage and the living wage in that context.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then I suppose moving on from that and the context that we're currently finding ourselves in with COVID-19, and we've seen, you know, massive amounts of job losses. Now, you know, hopefully a large number of those will be temporary. We've seen wage decreases and subsidised wages. The latest Daft report released last month tentatively signals that there's a possible reduction in asking rates, depending on the extent of economic damage caused by COVID-19. We know that chains have been temporarily impacted. What impact overall do you think that will have on the MESL and consequently on the living wage in the next couple of years?
Yes, it's hard to know, really, in a sense. I mean, in one regard, I suppose the minimum and the cost of this benchmark, when we leave out those factors like housing and childcare, and you sort of talk about the what we call the core basket, you know, food, clothing, and things you're going to need for a household, heating costs, and so on. They have stayed remarkably stable over the last number of years through both recession and coming out of recession. The big changes and fluctuations in the costs have really been those other areas. Because, and in a sense, I suppose it's what was required for a minimum stays fairly stable. You know, we just completed a review process where we went back to focus groups and discussed again what makes up the baskets. You know, there's been a few changes, you know, around whether people need a smartphone or not and things like that, you know, but basically the vast majority of the basket has stayed the same. And even where some new item like a smartphone has come into the basket, it's replaced a bunch of other things. So really the impact on it, it's what people need hasn't changed. It's how they get what they need has changed, in a sense. And I don't really see that changing much because of the impact of COVID. So in that sense, the basic cost for the minimum, I wouldn't imagine, is going to change massively one way or the other. It's those other factors, that what are people's housing costs when trying to live on a minimum, whether they can access services for like social housing or assistance with rent, or they're just left to market rents. And similarly with childcare, if what sort of supports are there to meet childcare costs, are going to be the big factors. And obviously then, and as we see in the context of COVID, health, because if you don't qualify for the medical card, and even if you do, what that brings you versus requiring health insurance or other costs around health are the big questions. What's also been remarkable, I suppose, in all of this has been how things that were, as lots of people have said, things that were previously unthinkable suddenly became very, you know, acceptable. You know, the €350 a week payment suddenly wasn't an issue, albeit for a short term, whereas in the minimum work we would talk about a core social welfare payment of €245 a week being the basis for sort of adequacy. albeit in the context of things like adequate housing supports and childcare supports and so forth. Same really with the living wage, you know, the, you know, adequate hours and things like that for, you know, what were previously regarded as, you know, basic unskilled jobs are now kind of our essential frontline jobs. You know, so there's a, you know, it would be interesting, I suppose, to see how all of this, or if it does change the discourse, the dialogue around these things as we kind of come out the other side of all of this. But I think the in terms of the impact on what's actually needed for a minimum, I don't really see it having a huge impact, because I think the minimum is just that. It's the minimum, and it tends not to fluctuate hugely irregardless, because this was, it doesn't have a lot of luxury built into it, so there's not a lot that can be stripped out of it in times of, you know, pandemic or anything else.
And finally, and I think you've probably touched on some elements of this already, what recommendations would you make to, say, our next government, this new government to be formed, to ensure a minimum standard of living for everybody?
Yeah, I think this was, there are a few that, again, they haven't changed for us for a number of years. I think the first and foremost is that policy decisions around whether it's social welfare rates, minimum wage rates, and so on, should be informed by evidence and benchmarked on, you know, on the basis of research and data, and not just what's politically expedient or politically viable or viewed as viable at any given moment. So I suppose coming into this, coming up to the election, it was a different time, but still coming up to that time, we were starting to see talk about, you know, benchmarking social welfare rates and talk of a social welfare commission and such. And there seems to be now, in the kind of what's come out this morning about the programme for government, there seems to be some talk of a social welfare commission. So we'd hope that that would start to look at the possibilities of kind of using evidence, like being informed by things like our research, the Minimum Essential Standard of Living research, as to where social welfare rates would need to be. Similarly with things like minimum wage and low pay work and so forth, again, it's kind of ensuring an adequate standard of living, and whether that's through the living wage or things like living hours and ensuring people have adequate hours. And, you know, kind of, so it's not just wage rates, it's the people have adequate hours and underemployment and all of those kind of issues that are there again. And then the crucial role of services, like I was saying, that's, you know, and we always say, you know, the naming the people that have a minimum essential standard of living, it's not just about incomes, it's about the services that drive that cost. So whether that's obviously the primary ones being housing and childcare, but also like I said, health, or and then things like public transport, and addressing public transport costs could make a big difference to the cost of the basket for households. So I think those would be our big ones. All big.
Thank you so much for that. This has been a really interesting conversation for me, and I'm sure our listeners will really appreciate your time. Thank you so much, Robert Thornton.
Thank you.
Hopefully you found this episode interesting. Social Justice Ireland produced a 10-minute lesson podcast on the living wage and the national minimum wage, available to download from our website or wherever you're listening to this podcast now. For more information on the living wage, you can check out www.livingwage.ie. The resources produced by the Vincentian Partnership for Social Justice are also really worth checking out. For research and methodology on the minimum essential standard of living, check out www.budgeting.ie. Or if you want to look at the minimum income standard for a particular household type using their interactive calculator, that's available at www.misc.ie. And also, if you have any ideas that you'd like to see covered by us, please do email us on secretary@socialjustice.ie. Until next time, stay safe.